Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Hey, here we are again.
We are indeed, yes. I mean, I'm enjoying our Royal series. We're getting some very interesting new insights.
Well, I think today we're going to talk to one of the more colourful, but also one of the best connected, probably also one of the least discreet royal writers of them all.
Well, I hope so.
Give her an intro.
Well, Lady Colin Campbell is an author of mine. She's written several books, probably most famously a book on Diana, which came out just before Andrew Morton and said very much the same things. It was a book that she had originally worked with Diana on, and they'd fallen out. But she's also done, I think, some very good books on, for example, the marriage of the Queen and Prince Philip, on the Queen Mother. And most recently, a very successful book on Harry and Meghan. She's very well plugged in social circles. And I think she does get some very, very good material.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that. We've had a lot of response, actually, to the little royal season we're doing. Lots of new comments. I mean, if you comment, I like doing this. User JE2EY6X21, whatever, says how much he or she loves the podcast. And has found and watched lots of them. And a very, very astute young woman here, Helen Craig, who might be related to me, thought that the best thing about last week's show was you getting lost on your way to my house.
Right.
Well done, Helen. Well said. Elaine Edgar has joined the little family. Iona Marilyn. Lynn Hubbard, I think I may have mentioned Lynn before. Yes, Iona is from Canada. Interesting one here. Rebecca Donovan 934 said some really interesting things on YouTube about Meghan, kind of agreeing with you, I think, Andrew, on that matter. And lots of other people have been finding us. We're also, I look at the charts, we're really popular in Scandinavia at the moment. We're in the charts in Finland, Iceland, and Norway.
So, gosh,
it's probably quite we're moving dark this time of year. There's not a lot much else to do, is there?
Maybe. We're moving around the world. Well, I mean, I have only just come across a lot of the comments, and it is gratifying that people seem to feel that what we're doing is interesting and informative. It's,
yeah, and they're finding the old shows. Remember the one we did about Andrew and Fergie? I think we should go back to that subject, you know, when your book's a bit further advanced, because I think that one got nearly 1,000 views in the last 3 or 4 days. That's just on the YouTube, and that's just quite, probably more than our latest show did. So that's quite interesting.
People yes, it's find interesting those, go up and down.
To explore more.
Well, I hope people will come back to some of the old shows because we've got some great, you know, great material there, and it doesn't really date. I think we're pretty up to date with what we've got to say.
And I think we should, you know, we will, I'm sure, go back to some of the things we've done that are not royal related, the miscarriages of justice, campaigning journalists. I'd love to do a bit more on COVID. I thought that was such an interesting conversation.
Yeah. No, I think that, you know, we want to feel that we are pushing the dial on certain subjects. I mean, I think I've asked Adam Sisman, who's just written the book about John Le Carre's mistresses and how that informed his work, to come and talk to us, and he's agreed. So that's coming up.
Oh, that's really interesting. Cool. Oh, well, we've got quite a lot to cram in today. Shall we say goodbye to each other? And hello,
yes.
Lady CC.
Yep.
Let's do it.
Well, Lady Colin, we're delighted to have you with us today in our series on royal biographers. You've written a number of royal biographies, and I think possibly the most famous are your two books on Diana. You got there really before Andrew Morton in many respects, didn't you?
In all respects that were truthful and accurate. Although Diana had very good use of Andrew, and she would have tried to get good use out of me that she got out of Andrew, because really Andrew was her Goebbels, her minister of propaganda. And I don't for a second decry what he did. You know, had he not done what she wanted, he would never have written the book, and it would never have been the outstanding success that it was. And it would not have put him on the map. And I say good luck to Andrew. Unfortunately, all his claims of being first to this, that, and the other are absolutely fallacious. As I had to tell him on television in America once, if you are the successor, you cannot be the predecessor.
Because, I mean, she wanted to do a book with you, and you did go some way down the line, and she gave you a lot of information, didn't she?
Well, we started off, my first Diana book started off as an authorized biography focusing on her charity work. So it really was not a proper biography. It was going to be a sort of puff piece to make money for three of her charities that were three of my charities. And I went into the palace, I saw Dickie Arbiter, because that's how it's done, I'm sure you know. You know, you decide things privately, then the royal tells you to write into X, Y, Z, A, B, and C, and it's handed over officially, and it's all green-lighted. And she then decided that she was going to take full advantage of the fact that well, at first, I was very amenable because she actually spoke the truth at first, which I knew already, that they were hopelessly mismatched. She had James Hewitt, he had Camilla, blah, 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 blah. And then at some point, I think she must have spoken to somebody, because she immediately changed horses in midstream. And having pretty much confirmed everything I knew about their marriage and why it had collapsed, which was hopeless incompatibility, she then decided that she was going to play the victim. And unfortunately, once I inquired into some of the things that she was claiming, I discovered they were totally untrue. And at that point, I was either going to go along with it, which is what Andrew did, or I was going to pull out, which is what I did.
And what were the lies that she was telling you?
Oh, you know that, I mean, at first it was that the marriage had broken up because they were basically incompatible. And she didn't understand certain things as well. For instance, she didn't understand that she had crossed the line when she slept with Barry Manicky. She just couldn't understand it. And I had to explain to her that you do not screw the staff. And she said, well, Princess Margaret and one of the other princesses who will remain nameless, she said, well, of course, they've been having affairs for years with their bodyguards. And I said, well, they're born princesses. You're not. You know, she didn't get that distinction. And I think to not meander too long, she decided she was going to make Charles into the ogre, having already confirmed that he was a very accommodating husband. He used to have James Hewitt to stay at Highgrove with his children as well. And, you know, he was very happy for her to have her own life, and he had his own life. And it was a very civilized arrangement and very traditional arrangement. And then
it's funny you should say that. It's very interesting to hear you say that, because Andrew and I had a long talk about the work that I did on the Diana's life. And I think one of the things I was amazed to discover was, for quite a few years, there really was an arrangement. And even though she wasn't always happy, it was sort of stable. And I think the tapes and then the briefings and the books clearly blew it apart. But Charles and his circle were quite relaxed about Hewitt. And for a while, she was even quite relaxed, maybe not totally, sort of relaxed about Camilla. Do you think that's right?
Oh, she was very relaxed about Camilla, as long as her love life was going along the way she wanted it to. There were problems, because if she became too keen on the man and wanted to marry him, for instance, she wanted to marry Oliver Hall, then there were huge problems. But if she, and at certain points she fantasized about marrying James, I don't think that was ever in reality a realistic prospect, but she found it. So when her private life was stable and was ticking over the way she wanted it to, everything was fine. If she became agitated because she wanted more out of the relationship with the current lover, then problems started. Or in the alternative, between men, then there were huge problems, and she would just go off the rails. Diana was very unstable, and I have a lot of sympathy for her, because she really suffered from borderline personality disorder, which is a terrible personality disorder to suffer from, because you suffer and so does everybody else around you. It's not like narcissism, where if you're a narcissist, you don't suffer, but everybody else is ripping out their hair. With borderline personality disorder, you suffer as well.
Well, I was very interested in the early part of your book, actually, as well. Your books, I've only read one, to be honest. But the Diana that we found, when we did a series of interviews with her childhood friends, her teachers, Mary Robinson, the woman that employed her, lots of the people in her circle in the years before she married. And that this idea that she was a complete ingenue, an innocent, a rather sort of weak character, we thought was nonsense, because it seemed to us that she was, if anything, a classic sort of young Sloane Ranger. Lots of fun, lots of parties, quite a few boyfriends, big personality. You wouldn't want to cross her because she would get quite angry with you. So the whole idea of her as this kind of blushing virgin when she got married seemed wrong. And I think you probably would agree with that from your writing.
No, she was never a blushing virgin. I mean, come on, you know. But she had a very sort of demure aspect to her personality. And she, for instance, was not the greatest conversationalist, although she could be great fun. So, you know, she loved cleaning up after dinner parties, that sort of thing. So, I mean, there was that slight awkward element to her personality when she was younger. And it developed into something else when she was older. But she was never... Barbara Cartland, who was my stepmother-in-law's best friend, when I was writing my first Diana book, she gave me 50 pages of notes and we spoke extensively. And she said, the public has Diana totally wrong. She was never, ever shy. All that head down, eyes up was because she was very tall. She said she was never, never shy ever. And the proof of the pudding is in the eating, because Diana, when she decided she was getting married and chose the dress, she told, I think it was Rosemary Pickman, I can't remember exactly who it was, it's so long, but she told one of her great friends that she was going to wow them and they were going to wake up and see that she had arrived. And Kenneth Rose, in his diaries, confirms that her father told him that Diana refused to allow him to wear his uniform because she didn't want him stealing her thunder. And Rose, in his diaries, says, there's something lair about Diana. And there was.
That's so interesting. Another thing that leapt out from your book to me was you used quite a lot of Joseph Sanders as a source.
Oh, yes.
The financial advisor. I got to know him a little bit as well. And I thought he was somebody that seemed to know Diana really, really well. And not many people have ever talked to him. And he's a great insight for those final years when she's slightly kind of bouncing around after the separation and the divorce and the whole period with Oliver Hoare. And I think he's terrific.
Well, Joseph and I were very great friends. In fact, I'm friends with his widow. His son is friends with my children. They used to go to each other's birthday parties. They're pretty much the same age. I met Joseph in, I think, 1975 or 76 at Cynthia and Murray Burford's. Murray is the present Duke of St. Albans. In those days, they were the Earl and Countess of Burford. And Joseph and I became great, great friends. He had a little glint in his eye for me, but he wasn't my type. But I really liked him. He was a great guy. And he and Diana were great, great friends. Not only was he her financial advisor, but she used to phone him 4 and 5 times a day, every single day. And Anita, his wife, said that she had no interest in her, Anita, but, you know, Joseph, she was all over Joseph like a rash for the whole time that she was alive.
And I think Joseph told you, didn't he, if I'm remembering correctly, that he thought towards the end she probably was looking to get married and may well have married Dodie, which other people say is not, other people have said that wouldn't have happened.
Oh, I know it would have happened because, I'm friendly with people who are friendly with the Khashoggis. And Dodie's mother was a Khashoggi. And when I was writing my posthumous Diana book, through a cousin of mine whose name is Princess Marta Arslan, I met Bushra Fakhouri, the famous sculptress, who is connected to the Khashoggi family. And Bushra introduced me to several of them, but I already knew AK, and I'd known him for years. And his son, Mohammed, was in my son Dima's class at Hill House. So I knew through the Khashoggis themselves, who hated Mohammed Fayed, incidentally, that Dodie had confirmed to his step uncle on the day of his death that he had proposed to Diana and she had accepted him. I also knew through Elsa Boka, because you see, I'm part Lebanese, and we're now speaking about the Middle Eastern community. Lady Boka was half Lebanese and half Egyptian, and I'd known Elsa forever. And Elsa was a great friend of Diana's, although she was much older than that. And Diana herself told Elsa, oh, Dodie covers me in love, and that she confirmed that she was going to marry him. And she also got in touch with the priest at St. Mary Abbott's. There's no doubt that Diana wanted to marry Dodie. Whether she would have married him or not is a moot point. She might have pulled out, but certainly at that stage, he had proposed, she had accepted, and people don't understand. Diana loved the fact that Dodie was a member of a billionaire family and that he was Middle Eastern. She loved the Middle Eastern culture. She loved the Middle Eastern family attitudes, the tremendous hospitality, the warmth that Middle Easterners cover people in a way that Britons do not, with due respect. And she loved all of that. And she also loved the goodies. She loved the yachts. She loved the private planes because, of course, she didn't have the class of money to be on yachts and private planes except under sufferance. But with the Fayeds, she would have had the right to all of them. And I'm sure that was a part of the consideration. And also, Dodie worshipped her, and Diana loved being worshipped. And Dodie was a worshipper. He was brought up to worship his father. And I have many of my friends, great friends, were great friends of Dodie. I never, ever met Dodie, so I didn't know Dodie. but I certainly have a very accurate idea of what happened at the time. Of course, Rosa Mountain, for instance, has all been dead against the fact that Dan would ever have married Dildy, because, and I have to say, there is a tremendous anti-Muslim vibe that I get from Rosa. Now, I don't know if it's because Dominic Lawson is Jewish, or if she just decided that she, but I do know that Diana was in the process of dumping Rosa. But the good thing where Rose is concerned is that Diana died before the dumping was accomplished.
Golly. And what was the reaction in the royal family? Were they aware that she might marry Dodie?
Well, she'd only accepted him the day that she died.
Right.
But my impression was that, because, I mean, they obviously had their finger on the pulse to a degree, and certainly will have known what happened afterwards, that they were delighted that Diana was going to be committing social suicide. I mean, Diana had been an albatross around their neck for years. And, you know, they were absolutely thrilled that she was going to be committing social suicide.
Do you think, had she survived, had she married him, how would you imagine her life going? Would there have been more children? Would she have mended her fences with the royals? Would she have been a famous philanthropist? Or what do you think would have happened to her?
When she had already started to mend her fences with Charles. I mean, they were getting on much better. She was accepting of the fact that he would marry Camilla. And this also freed her to marry whomever she pleased. So I think that she had been trying to mend fences. I mean, she mended fences with loads of people, including me. I mean, she did it very publicly as well. She did it at the Russian ambassador's residence in front of a room full of people for the first time. You know, she understood that she had been frozen out, and she didn't like the fact that she had been frozen out. And she tried to mend fences. But what would have happened, I think, had she married Dodi, because Mohammed was already setting up an international charity for her to be the leader of.
Oh, really?
Sorry?
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
And weren't they also looking at Julie Andrews' old house in California?
Yes, I think he bought it. I think he bought it, and that was going to be their California residence. That's right. He bought it.
And why had you fallen out with her? Was it she upset about the book, or was there another element to it?
Totally the book. I mean, she told Joseph. Joseph actually told me he thought it was funny, and so did I. She told Joseph, "I don't know who Lady Colin is. I've never seen her or met her." Joseph said, "You seem to forget." And she, well, you know, she was furious about the book. She was furious because she knew that I knew the truth. And I think she didn't expect me to write the book. Oh, I think she expected me to fold. But I'd accepted the advance. I'd started the book. I was not going to give back the advance. And as Diana used to say, the book was baby money. And she knew I wanted to be free of my family's restrictiveness, let's put it that way, and that I wanted to make my own money. And she encouraged me because you see, my book started out as a charity fundraiser, and with her encouragement, it was then switched to being an unauthorized but accurate biography, which I have to say gave me pause for thought, because I was not exactly eager to be ostracized. And in those days, the wisdom was if you said anything, even positively, about the royal family without their approval, you would be ostracized. And then I thought, well, and she kept on saying, oh, you want baby money, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, well, yeah, I do want the baby money. And also, my social position, such as it is and was not really that dependent on the British royal family or any connections I had in that regard. You know, I was born into a very well-established family. I have friends all over the world. I mean, you can't steal my ancestors, no matter how much you want to try. And so I thought, well, you know, if I blot my copy in England, there's still the rest of the world. And at that point, I proceeded to write a truthful book.
And what was the reaction when you produced this truthful book? Did people believe you?
Well, I mean, I was sort of naive, and I had listed absolutely everybody to whom I had spoken. And, you know, and they were all perfectly happy to be listed until the proverbial brown stuff hit the fan. This was before anybody, you know, this was before Morton's book had even been written. So I had a few months hanging out to dry, so to speak. And people like Barbara Cartland and Edward Montagu and Janet Milford Haven. Well, no, Janet, in fairness to her, did not recant publicly, but she was furious with me privately for mentioning her name. And I said, but Janet, you told me I could. Anyway, we kissed and made up. But Edward Montagu, I phoned him up and I said, how dare you lie and say that you didn't speak to me? I said, if you do it again, I'm going to sue you. And I said something very nasty about his past and his prison record, which I will not repeat now, but it certainly zinged home. And I said, and if you think you're going to get away with anything else again, you can think again. And I phoned a Barbara and I said to her, how dare you say that you, I said, I've got 50 pages of notes. And she said, oh, well, sweetie, she said, you know, you just don't seem to understand. Nobody speaks the truth to the press. I said, well, you better damn well start if you know what's good for you. Otherwise, I'll have your clutch box in a court of law.
you've since written a book on Harry and Meghan. Did you have a similar reaction when you did that?
I had no interest in Harry and Meghan whatsoever. It came to me. I think it came to me because of my Diana books and my Diana record. And I think people were very concerned as to what Meghan was up to and that the direction she was leading Harry in by his nose. And his nose does not repose on his face. It reposes elsewhere.
And point taken.
Good.
Like many members of the royal family.
What?
The Windsor men.
Yeah. Exactly. And the story came to me and people, I can't say who or anybody, you know, I can't give too many details.
So people in the establishment were leaking information on Meghan because they wanted a critical account, because your book was quite critical of Meghan.
No. I think they wanted me to write the book. And remember, this was before they'd left. They wanted me to write the book, so a shot across her bow, so that she would stop her antics, for instance, her commercial activities, her troublemaking, trying to expand her role into political areas. And I think they thought that if I wrote that trouble was brewing behind the scenes, I would do it delicately, but decisively, because I know exactly how far to go. I never go further than I should. And, you know, if the iceberg is shown, there's usually quite a bit beneath it. I'm very careful and measured as to what I actually do say and how I say it. And they are aware of it.
Were you surprised the way that the Meghan relationship with the royal family ended, insofar as it ended? Or did you see that coming, that there would be a big break in the way that there was?
Nobody saw it. I don't think anybody saw it. And I don't, I mean, my book was supposed to be delivered, I think, 2 or 3 weeks after the Mexited, you know, which caused a huge problem for me. And also, I had to change a whole lot of stuff aside from the end, because the focus shifted dramatically. And, you know, instead of just being a shot across the bow, it had to become something, a tale of departure and recalcitrance. And so nobody saw it coming, so far as I'm aware.
And what does the future hold? So what does the future hold for them, do you think, now? How is it going to play out?
I don't believe in making predictions. I'm not a fortune teller. But I will say, character is destiny, and you only need to see what they have done so far and how they have systematically misplayed their hand at every stage. Meghan is a small-time operator in a big boy's game. Meghan is like one of those, I don't know if they still exist now, but in New York in the latter part of the last century, you would be walking up Fifth Avenue or Park Avenue or Lexington Avenue, and there'd be all of these people, card people, you know, playing this some game, and that's Meghan. That's a category of Meghan's game playing. And then all of a sudden she is on the Titanic with super card sharks as well as super rich people who are able to be fleeced. And she's totally out of her league. And I think that you only need to see the way she has functioned to see how totally out of her league she is and how she has misplayed her hand at every stage. Because she is unsophisticated. She has no nuance. She's an operator. And
is it all her, or is there some element of Harry here? Because, I mean, there's a sense with Spare that, I mean, he feels very embittered. And, I mean, he, in a sense, is not quite the innocent dupe that perhaps people thought he was.
Oh, I think there's no doubt that, you know, Iago hit a nerve with Othello. And Othello obviously had it within him to be murderous. Otherwise, Desdemona would have survived. But would Othello have throttled Desdemona had Iago not existed? No, of course, none of it would have happened. And I happen to know some of the... let's not even go there.
All right. Well, I it's such a joy to talk to you. I'm sort of jumping around a little because I'm aware we don't have much more time. But since we've talked about aristocratic arrangements within relationships historically and the Windsor men and how they've acted historically, I'd love to talk to you briefly about the Queen. So I know you've written about her and her marriage. Do you think that what she had with Philip is an example of an arrangement that worked, or did the Crown get it wrong?
I haven't seen the Crown.
Okay.
I saw, I think, the first two series. And quite frankly, I was so disgusted by the end of it all.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And I thought it was the worst sort of entertainment, beautifully executed, but really rather lethal. And let's not forget that Peter Morgan's father-in-law is Prince Schwarzenberg. So, I mean, I could make a comment or two in that regard, which I will refrain from. I think that the Queen's marriage, the Queen was utterly besotted with Prince Philip when she met him, and she remained in love with him for the rest of her life. I think he loved her too. I think there's little doubt in my mind that he genuinely loved her, and he was prepared to make the sacrifices for the position that he and she held, and he did it willingly. He did it at great cost to his ambitions, but he did do it. And I think, you know, if you saw them in a room together, he'd be on one side, she'd be on the other, and they just flick each other a little look. I mean, that's not fakeable, you know.
But you certainly hint in the Royal Marriages book on a series of affairs that Philip had in the course of his life. Did that exist alongside this very close love affair?
I think Philip was a great flirt. I'm not sure that it went beyond the drawing room, but it certainly was definitely flirting in the drawing room. I mean, Philip had an eye for a pretty girl, and he loved flirting. To what extent it went beyond that, I would prefer not to go there, because there's absolutely no actual proof. I mean, you do have people like Sasha Abercorn saying that they actually never, ever, ever, ever had anything carnal between them. And I believe Sasha Abercorn, you know, and she was supposed to be his great, great love before Penny Mountbatten came along.
And she was a great love of Lord Mountbatten too.
Who, Sasha?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's... And let's remember that Penny Mountbatten is Lord Mountbatten's grandson's wife. And Prince Philip was a Mountbatten. You know, people don't seem to get it. That first of all, he could have been her father. And secondly, he was a member of the family. And I also think that the average person doesn't understand that very grand people are isolated to a large extent and gravitate towards usually people within their families or people to whom they're connected, who they know are going to be nurturing of their human needs. Everything doesn't have to be sex, you know. You can have very close personal relationships. And also, Philip was one of five with four elder sisters who spoiled him rotten. He loved women. He genuinely loved women. But he also loved men. I mean, nobody's suggesting he was a homosexual. But he really loved, he had very close relationships with men as well as with women. And I think you need to remember that in some ways he was extremely emotionally, I'm trying to find the right word.
Sophisticated?
Sorry?
I was going to say sophisticated, but because of his childhood.
Yeah, he was sophisticated, but he was also very emotionally self-reliant. But with that self-reliance went a great deal of emotional need and spiritual need to interact with people. You know, he was, I mean, Robin Dalton, who was a sort of friend of mine, not a close friend. She was a very close friend of a very close friend of mine. And she lived with David Milford Haven for years at the time of his marriage to Princess Elizabeth. And she said that Philip was a real cold fish. And in fact, I quoted her in my book. I forget it's, I think it's most likely The Queen's Marriage. And, you know, she said Philip was a real cold fish, meaning he was not emotionally needy. He was needy of spiritual connection and human connection, but he wasn't emotionally needy. I think he was a very complex personality. And yeah, he was a huge flirt. And let me tell you, he had an eye for a pretty girl. You never walked into a room that he didn't pass some sort of flirtatious comment.
And did Prince Andrew pick up this, do you think? Did he inherit it? And do you think Prince Andrew is any threat to the monarchy, or has he been sort of neutralised?
Well, my take on Prince Andrew, I think you know Andrew, is that he has been gloriously set up. And I think that Prince Andrew has been given a tremendously harsh ride by a professional, by her own admission, who not only received money for her claim, $15,000, by her own account, for having claimed to have been to bed with him, notwithstanding the fact that the people who I know, who know Prince Andrew extremely well, say his tastes don't run in that direction.
To men, you mean, rather than women, or just old women?
That's not what I mean, and I'm not going to have to put words in my mouth.
But I mean, older woman.
Naughty boy. The Andrew thing I have covered elsewhere, and I think it's too complex to go into here and now.
So why hasn't Andrew, in a sense, sort of defended himself better? I mean, he settled with Geoffrey. He's didn't give a particularly helpful interview for Newsnight. You know, he hasn't played his cards very well.
Well, he's not very bright, and he's not very sophisticated.
But he must have advisors.
You know, if you don't listen to your advisors, they're as good as the stones on the ground. He felt that he needed to do it so that he could walk his daughter down the aisle unblemished without all of this nonsense coming up. And he miscalculated. And I have to say also, I mean, I think that Emily Maitlis, in some ways, was inhumane, because every single public figure, and I now speak as a public figure, has been in a situation where they have said highly incriminating things without realizing what they have said and what the spin can be put upon it.
But I mean, he said a number of things which are untrue in the Newsnight interview. You know, he said he couldn't sweat. He said he hadn't seen Epstein after a particular time. You know, that makes one worry that maybe, you know, if he's lying on those things, he must be lying on other things.
Well, I don't know that he was lying on that he can't sweat thing. And, you know, they published a photograph of him in a Sialan cotton shirt, and the glisten of the Sialan cotton shirt is what they said was sweating. Well, I'm afraid people don't sweat on their shoulder blades, sort of thing. But what I think, where he hanged himself on that interview was by saying that he did not regret the association with Jeffrey Epstein, that he got a lot out of it. And I think he was genuinely trying to be honest. And he didn't understand the impact that it would have. She understood the impact it would have. I mean, I've been in a similar situation with my first Anna book, where I gave an interview to gratis my brother to one of his clients who owned a newspaper. And fortunately, the journalist, she asked me a question and I gave the answer. And she said, "You can't say that." She said, if I print that," she said, "it will destroy your reputation." And Emily Maitlis will have been only too clear about the fact that she could have, and she could have easily cut it out and said to Andrew, "Don't say that. You can't say that. You mean," but she didn't. Now you could say, "He's an adult. She's a journalist." Well, they're also human beings. And he effectively then had to fall on his sword because if he didn't, it was going to destroy the Queen's Jubilee. Mm. And he knew that she was dying, as did I, as did everybody who knew anything, knew that she was dying. So he did the right thing. He did the
deal. And is there any way back for him now, or do you think that's his life over?
No. I don't think so. I think privately, yes, I mean, he has, you know, he still gets asked to country houses and shoots on that sort of thing. And he has his own shoots, etc. But I rarely think, no, I think he has been compromised beyond redemption.
Well, shall we say, because I think we have to wrap this up now, but shall we say, we could maybe have you back to review Andrew's book on Andrew, because I really, really want to hear you call Andrew a naughty boy again. That was the highlight, the highlight of my podcasting life so far. And I thank you for it.
Well, I have to read the book first.
Yes. Well, you'll be one of the first to read it.
Thank you so much. That was absolutely brilliant conversation. Really enjoyed it. And I appreciate your time.
And you always have very interesting insights. Thank you.
Thanks, bye. Okay.
Well, a lot of fascinating stuff there, new stuff.
You are such a naughty boy, Andrew.
I've been pushing her on certain things. She wasn't going to go public on some of them. But still, quite a lot of revelations there. I mean, clearly very well connected, and that's how she gets a lot of her material. And that's, I think, one of the keys. You know, you can work in the archives, but if the stuff isn't there, it's with the gossip.
Mm, interesting. No, I thought it was such an interesting conversation. Very entertaining. I really enjoyed it. So now we're going to do something a bit different. We've talked about doing this, and now we're going to do it. We're going to have a chat to somebody we've found, or has found us, through this podcast. Julie Koenig from Ohio, who has been listening to us and sending comments for quite some time. And we thought we'd have a chat to her about the sort of thing she's interested in, and she can ask us questions about the stuff that we do.
Yes, and I'm looking forward to that. It's nice that we've got someone, you know, in the States who's clearly well informed and interested.
Yeah, and if people like it, let us know, and maybe we can do more of this kind of thing. I mean, before we go to Julie, do you want to talk a little bit about upcoming episodes? We mentioned earlier that we're hoping to do one more Royal One and then move back to other things.
Well, we've got a series of, series of things that come up. People have asked about, for example, the Romanovs and the Kennedys. I think it's, you know, I think we probably should do some more miscarriages of justice. We've talked over the last 2 years about doing David Kelly, which is a bit of a mystery. So I think there are a lot of stories out there that perhaps really repay further examination.
Jolly, jolly good. All right. Should we go to Ohio?
Let's go across the Atlantic.
All right. See you in a minute.
Well, hello, Julie, and hello, King Charles. you must tell us how you came to become friends.
So I visited the UK for the coronation in May. My cousin gave me this lovely life-size cutout of Charles and said, "You have to take him back to the States." So here he is. It caused quite a commotion at Heathrow Airport because he couldn't go. He couldn't be checked with our luggage. So we had to go to another desk. There was nobody there. Then we had to go somewhere else to pack him. So a lot of effort to get Charles back.
Did he travel first class?
Definitely not.
Oh, hello. It was very, very nice to meet you. Meet you in person. And thank you so much for reaching out to us with your comments and thoughts over the last few months. I'm guessing that's not an Ohio accent.
It is not. And actually, I have another story from the coronation. When we were there a few days before, you know, walking around the mall with millions of other people, lots of police were there, and we got talking to one guy from Yorkshire. And my husband's American. So he said to me, he said, "So, well, you're not American, so where are you from?" And I said, "Well, can't you guess?" And he said, "No, I can't." I said, "Well, actually, I'm from the Midlands." And he said, "Well, you've certainly lost your Midlands accent, so I think that's a good thing."
You come from up north too, don't you, Phil?
I do. We consider the Midlands of South where I come from, but that's a different story. So why are you so interested in the British, particularly the British royal family, and why have you continued to kind of research them and speak about them in your new life in America?
Yeah, so, well, intrinsically, they're part of our culture, being British. I didn't move to the States until I was 32, so I was well indoctrinated into the culture. My family, except my dad, we were all royalists. And really, my interest started when, like everybody else, Diana came on the scene. She was 3 years older than me. So that's where the interest started. And then last year, I started just giving talks at my mother-in-law's retirement community. They were very popular. Then I went to another retirement community down the street from where I live. And then the Queen died, and the press inexplicably got my number. So have you seen my work on Fox 8 News and Channel 19?
Oh, we will link to it.
We will link, yes, exactly.
So that was really the catalyst. You know, when people say, find something that you love to do and you'll never work a day in your life. Well, and that was the catalyst for me. I just love talking about it. And you guys have taken me to a whole other level, because I thought I knew everything about Diana, and I don't. And it's nice to hear a different view. But then all the other stories associated with the royals, and sometimes not the royals, the East India company podcast that you did, listened to it twice.
Well, that was fun, wasn't it?
Good.
Is it the scandalous side of life, or is it the sort of dignified, historic side of life that attracts people? Because I'd love to know if the whole Harry Meghan, it must come up all the time when you meet people to talk about the British royals.
Yeah, I do private events now, libraries, senior centres. And, you know, when I started, and I think Harry and Meghan had just moved to the States, everybody asked, what do you think about Camilla? And then it soon changed to, I can be doing a presentation about British royal weddings. And one of the questions at the end is always, what do you think about Harry and Meghan? And my stock answer is, I'm Switzerland. But that doesn't fly. We definitely get into it. And I think when I started, people were supportive after the Oprah interview. But this year, I think the support has really waned.
Is it both of them together or is it them separately? I mean, are people more sympathetic to him than they are to her?
I think, well, yesterday's talk I did, definitely there are no fans of Meghan. And I think the interest is, you know, to your point, Phil, I think it's the history, the pomp and ceremony the Americans love. But there's also the scandals and the salacious gossip that they're interested in also. Yeah.
I mean, they are different and they're so dysfunctional. I suppose like most families, but they just do it on a bigger scale.
On a bigger scale, and how sad is it that this had to play out? You know, I really feel sorry for William and Catherine, the way this has had to play out on a global scale.
It is sad. I think I've spoken before about, I was actually in Australia when the Harry and Meghan, that incredible wedding took place. And in Australia, on the other side of the world, people were dressing up to go to the pub to watch it on the telly. There was such goodwill to her especially. It is a real shame.
Yeah, and people, you know, I was asked yesterday, you know, was the Queen racist because, you know, she treated Meghan so badly? So I had two sides to it. There was one lady saying that, and then another lady saying, Meghan is the worst thing that happened to the royal family. Like I said, I think there was a support, and now I think it's gone. And I think the big thing to realise is the way you get the news in the UK and we get the news in the States. So sometimes it's just the salacious gossip. So, for example, a couple of months ago, there was the big car chase in New York with Harry and Meghan, and that was a big story. So my local news that broke in the morning, the local news put that story on at 6 p.m. Well, by then it had been debunked that there was no car chase. The New York chief of police had come out, the mayor had come out, and anybody who's ever been to New York, there's no high-speed car chases in New York. Everybody knows that without them coming out and saying it. But the news just reported that there was a high-speed car chase. So immediately that's just lazy journalism, but that's probably more important to the story than debunking the story.
It's what people want to believe. I think we should make you our royal correspondent in the States.
I would love that.
Could report what's going on there that we're missing here, because I suspect there's stuff reported in the States that isn't reported here. For example, William's affairs, I think, are covered in the States in a way they're not covered in this country.
Correct. So do you think William is having affairs?
I don't know. I haven't been able to read anything.
I literally no idea. If it's anything like any of the other Windsors, probably yes, but I don't know.
We need to see if someone can help us on that, or maybe we need to address that in a future talk. I mean, we're interested in hearing what you feel we should be talking about, because we've done a lot of royal stuff, but, I mean, you said you like the East India. Should we be balancing it a bit more? We've just done a run of, you know, several programmes.
I would love you to do more of that. I would love to hear more about the abdication. And I know you've touched on that in a previous podcast, but I think there's more to that. And even, you know, I do my talks and you see, it was so great the other night. I should have taken a video. I put up the PowerPoints of your books and the books that I recommend, and people were getting their phones out and taking screenshots. And I was just talking a little bit high level about the books. And, you know, especially Traitor King, that blew me away. I didn't realise everything that was involved.
Andrew, you should reconsider your retirement planning. I think Northern Ohio looks like a good spot.
Yes, I could give talks as well.
Amongst a lot of friends.
Or I could be shouting back of the room saying, no, I don't believe that.
Yeah, it's interesting. But, you know, just quickly going back to William, there was something on Twitter that was completely made up by someone, and they said, oh yeah, it was just a joke with Rose Hanbury.
Anyway. The British journalist Giles Corran has said it all started in a drunken conversation in a pub, and he claims there's absolutely nothing in it, but who knows really?
Right, I mean, you know, I don't want there to be anything in it. I can't take another royal scandal.
No, I think there is a lot of goodwill still for William and Kate, and I think a certain amount of sympathy, given all the kind of rough stuff that was said in Harry's book.
Yeah. Well, I think you wanted to ask us who our favourite royals were, and certainly my favourite royal would be Kate. I think there's an interesting piece in the paper here in Britain today saying it's actually the women coming into the royal family who are the ones who really stiffen the backbone and make them better people. And the Windsor men are pretty gormless, generally.
I would agree. And, you know, just to add to that, I really feel like her family doesn't get anywhere near enough credit for their hand in all of this, the way they raised her, the way they've behaved through all of the years, because the press has not been kind to them. I think they need far more praise than they get. I think they're obviously a great model for any family, the way they conduct themselves.
I would agree with Andrew. Also, with my Australian hat on, you know, the republicanism was really popular in Australia for a while. It really, people thought it was only a matter of time. And so many of my friends said, when the Queen dies, that's it. there's respect for her, but when she goes, we need to be an properly independent country. But on my last trip, every supermarket checkout, oh, look, Charlotte's got a new dress. Oh, God, isn't George adorable? Oh, Louis with his hand. It's just, they've kind of relaunched the brand. And I think, actually, I'm probably making this up a little bit, but I think that support for Republicanism is, if anything, gone down in these places.
Well, I think what we have is a much more forward-looking monarchy than we had. It was a sort of rather like an old Russian Politburo before with the Queen. Now we have this idea of the next two generations are pretty clear. And they seem a pretty nice family, and they seem to be very low key. I think they get that balance right between informality and dignity, which some of them can't seem to manage.
I wonder if Kate will turn out to be a bit like the Queen if she lives that long. You know, she seems to have that kind of, you know, just grin and bear it, do your job, smile, you know, be appropriately kind of warm and friendly, but not too much. That sense of detachment.
Well, the mystique, back to the mystique, you know, I suppose once they let the open the door, then it was open house.
Yeah, wasn't that, was that Winston Churchill who said you should never open the door to the mystique and the magic of the royal family? And I think, you know, Kate is one of my favourite royals too. And I think, what do we really know about her? We know the general stuff growing up, but really we don't know what's her favourite food. We know she likes to play tennis, but we don't know much. And I really see that with her. And I talk about this in my presentations that, yeah, I do see the Queen, you know, in her. Even the way she presents herself, the way she dresses, the way she is with the colours, like the Queen used to say, I need to be seen to be believed. You can see Kate taking a leaf out of her book there. And then, yeah, we don't know much about her, which adds to us being more interested.
And you've also got some questions for us, I think.
I do. And I really want your thoughts on this one, because I scratch my head and I don't have a lot of, you know, I don't have any thoughts on it. So why do the royals find it so difficult to separate the business of monarchy? I mean, they are called the firm for a reason, from the family. And I guess, you know, just to expound on that a little bit, you know, Harry is still in the line of succession because, well, birthright, and he's still a councillor of state. That seems absurd to me. And does it all just come down to birthright? But can't somebody issue letters patent? I mean, I'm really getting out of my comfort zone here with what I know and don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, they use letters patent to basically, you know, disenfranchise Wallace and take away her HRH. I think it is interesting. I mean, you know, and clearly we have, you know, their role also within the head of the Church of England. I think their problem is that they have to represent the nation as the family of the nation. And yet, as a family, because I think their upbringing has been so, has not been very good, I think for generations, you know, they create these people who are not very well adjusted, and feel self-entitled. And, you know, a few like William seem to be, get through it and fine. And then the ones like Harry, I think, struggle. And maybe it's
Andrew too. About,
and Andrew too, exactly. The spare, the problem of what you do with the spare. But I would have thought that I would love to be the spare. I haven't got my whole life preordained for me. I can marry the woman I want. I would have thought there's a great deal of jealousy by Charles towards Andrew and William towards Harry. So I think it's the character, and I blame the Hanoverians and the Bowes Lion. I think they just brought in some very bad blood.
Interesting.
Bowes Lions. I'm just reading a book about the Queen Mum. It's quite a light-hearted book, but wasn't there some craziness in that family?
Exactly. They were discouraged from marrying them. And the Spencers also have, and that one of the reasons that Earl Spencer didn't marry Anne Glenconner was because he was regarded as having the family as having a strait of madness.
Right. Do you have anything else to ask us? Because we are our time slot here.
So Phil, who's your favourite royal? And you both have to tell me your least favourite, or you don't have to if you'd rather not. But
no, how long you got?
Well, I think my least favourite has to be Edward the Traitor King. I mean, Andrew's book is so strong on that, and I'm actually doing some research myself into a book about the Second World War, And the further you delve into the kind of circles around him, the nastier and nastier it gets. I mean, it's really foul stuff, actually. I mean, the guy would have sold us out in a heartbeat. Seriously bad man. I mean, above and beyond any nasty dynastic disputes or marital infidelities. I mean, this was a man who was kind of like happy to be friends with Nazis. And I guess Diana is my favourite still. You know, I wrote my book, I did my series. I spent an awful lot of time. All my friends said, oh, for goodness sake, Phil, you know, she will, you know, don't fall for the charm. There's so many things that are wrong with her. But actually, I think that the charming, the professional, the funny, the slightly flirtatious side, the side that Patrick Jefferson talks so well about, even at the end, is the side people are forgetting now. And I think that's a shame. I think she had a terrific personality in many ways.
I'd agree with Edward, probably, you know, he's the least favourite because of the way he behaved. But the problem is I like the rogues. In some ways, my favourite are the rogues. You know, I have a soft spot for Princess Margaret and even Prince Andrew. I love people who are self-entitled and pompous because they're so much more fun to write about.
That's a good point. that's probably a good end note because we're way over because we're trying to squeeze you in alongside Lady Colin Campbell. By the way.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh.
We're getting longer. We're getting
cozy.
Felt people, we did 40 minutes and now we're moving to think more towards the hour. I think people feel that they can cope with an hour of us now.
Good. And I thought of some more people that I'll put in an email to you that you should talk to.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Very good to see you.
Nice to talk to you.
Best wishes to Charles. There he is.
And I'll talk to you soon. Yes. Give our best to Charles.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.